This is an ABC podcast.
Tala for lover and warm Pacific greetings. I'm Talia Olatia and you're listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the program, the people of New Caledonia will again be voting whether to remain with the French Republic this weekend. More than 180,000 people are expected to cast their vote at the independence referendum, and you'll get a preview of how one voter is feeling in less than 10 minutes. Also this morning, you'll meet Elsie Albert, who this weekend will make history as the first Papua New Guinean-born woman to play in Australia's NRL women's competition.
I can't really explain the feeling, you know, growing up back then when there's no women league televised on the TV, Jonathan Thurston and Greg Inglis, and you would cheer for them. And now, like, I can wrap my head around this feeling that I get to play in that same arena.
Those stories coming up, but first to Palau, where the race is on to see who'll be their next president.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Palau's incumbent president, Tommy Remengesau Jr., is choosing to retire to become a fisherman, meaning the country's top job will be up for grabs on November 3rd at the general election. It is, of course, a crucial time with Palau's tourism-dependent economy in crisis, as Palau's borders remain closed, except for essential travellers, because of the global COVID-19 pandemic. And while many voters are happy for that to remain the case, some presidential candidates propose they reopen in some capacity. And a long-standing ally, Taiwan, is set to be first in line. From Palau's capital, Koror, here's Bernadette Carrion.
Life is a lot quieter here with no tourists. But that's also made life very difficult for people like Jeff Barabe, who owns several hotels and restaurants.
Yeah, we're losing money every month right now, and we're looking to make decisions about how we're going to continue to maintain our viability.
He's been in Palau 20 years and says while they've always prepared for rainy days, things are still extremely tough.
We've run our companies very conservatively. We've always planned for not good, but issues. Palau's dealt with some big problems in the past. Viability of our companies, I think, is strong. We are now looking at the fall 2021, see any substantial recovery. What we're planning to do is just kind of minimize our losses on a monthly basis and try to build the local market as much as possible.
Palau's economy is feeling the brunt of its COVID-19 self-isolation. Here's how President Tommy Remengesau Jr. put it last week in a speech at the United Nations.
Sometimes we hear people say that health is more important than money, and that is certainly true. But a national economy is not money. It is the system that determines quality of life and that delivers critical public services. It is food on the table. This pandemic has put Palau into a level of isolation we have not known for many, many years. We struggle with disruptions to supply chains for food and essential medicines. We struggle to connect patients with life-saving medical treatment. We struggle to keep families united, to keep college students in school, and to keep family breadwinners working. Private sector unemployment is approaching 50%, and it will take years to recover what we have lost in months.
That has meant the state of the economy and ways to solve the crisis are playing a central role in this year's parliamentary and presidential elections in early November. But people already had started having their say on who they want to be president last week, in the first of two rounds of voting. While the official results are expected to be announced this week, two of the four candidates have already conceded, leaving Palau's current Vice President Raynald Oilu to face off against Ronald Whips Jr., who's trying again after running unsuccessfully 4 years ago. Raynald Oilu says his priority is to keep Palau COVID-free.
At the same time, I am realistic that Palau cannot continue to close its borders forever. We need to find a way where we can slowly open our borders, especially with the countries which we know are safe as far as COVID-19 is concerned. So at the moment, the only place that is pretty strong in terms of preventing COVID-19 is Taiwan.
That is in line with the current government policy. After all, Mr. Oilo is still vice president. Here's outgoing President Rumingasao.
Taiwan, a public health leader that has implemented one of the world's most effective pandemic responses, was left out of the global response to this pandemic, and that made the world less safe. In this pandemic, Taiwan has generously shared its experience and expertise with Palau. Taiwan is one of the only places on Earth that is safe enough for quarantine-free travel with COVID-free nations like Palau. And we are currently working together to create the world's first safe bubble economy.
Surang Whips Jr. also supports the idea of a travel bubble with Taiwan, although Boatman says they will listen to the advice of health authorities. In the longer term, though, Whips is promising to reduce Palau's reliance on the tourism sector.
If you want a successful country, you need good health care, you need good education, you need a strong workforce, you need justice, and then you can build a strong economy. What are the elements of that can help Palau with what we're facing and the economy we need? We need to diversify, first of all. Healthcare is an economy that we can pursue. Also, education. But then there's no question, we need to invest in agriculture and aquaculture.
Meanwhile, Vice President Oilo is daring to suggest that should he win, he'd consider allowing cruise ships again, despite the problems they face in the early days of the pandemic.
That's before we knew about this COVID-19. But now that we know, I think we can allow this cruise ship to come to Palau, but ensuring also that they do not carry COVID-19. And that's by doing, Palau can require this cruise ship to do quarantine before they get on board, do conduct testing before they get on board, and then come to Palau. When they come to Palau, they will also have a very limited interaction with the community because they will simply rent boats to go to the Rock Island and dive and then go back to their ship. So, and yet that's money coming into Koror State to these boat operators. So to me, that's really another way that we can really start at the moment.
But many people here in Palau are happy to keep tourists out.
I don't think we're ready to open up our borders completely. I think that would be a huge risk, especially if the reason is for tourism.
I wouldn't want it to open right away, like not in this year, and maybe not like 2021, like early 2021, until like maybe the cases go down a little bit, and if there's like, you know, if they have vaccines for it. Yeah.
I do not think Palau is ready to open its borders yet. We recently experienced a scare. I don't think the current capacity of our hospital can handle even one case of coronavirus.
But even some people with links to the tourism sector aren't in a rush to reopen borders, like diving pioneer Francis Toribion, who's also the brother of another former Palawan president.
I think we can wait 5 more months and try to open it. At the same time, we need to put a program together, if people come and have a test, whether they're positive or negative. If they're negative, then you can quarantine them for maybe 3 days, and then they can do it all day. If you talk about 14 days, then forget about it. Nobody wants to come into that.
That was retired Palau businessman Francis Terobiong, ending that report from Bernadette Carrion in Palau.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The people of New Caledonia will head to the polls in just under a week for the second time in 2 years to have their say on whether the Pacific Territory should become independent from France. Among them is Emily Dotsaro, who was just a toddler when New Caledonia went through its civil war, a time where Indigenous Canuck militants fought for independence against French forces. Those events led to a peace deal and more than 30 years of stability, and Dr. Dotsaro believes that that experience has greatly influenced her generation's thoughts on independence. And now, as the territory gears up for a second referendum on independence on Sunday, she says being New Caledonian is a lot more complex than just a yes or no vote. She spoke with reporter Priyanka Srinivasan.
My name is Emily Dotsaru. I'm originally from New Caledonia. On my mother's side, one of these descendants of convict people who were brought to New Caledonia by France several generations ago. And I grew up my first few years in France, where my parents were students, and then all the rest of my childhood and teenage years in New Caledonia. And then I left when I was 19 years old to go to university in France and then in Australia. So that's me.
New Caledonians will be facing this question on independence on October the 4th. How do you feel about your own identity? Do you feel French, Kanaki, New Caledonian, Australian?
Yeah.
How do you think about that question?
Where I lie is in New Caledonia. That's really the basic of my identity as a person. That's recognizing that it involves some French heritage, but because also I have some from my father's side anyway, but the French, you know, teaching system and education system and the French language, etc., when you grew up in New Caledonia. But there is also all the Pacific, you know, the Pacifica and Oceanian aspect to it when you grow up there. And maybe people don't realize it until they leave New Caledonia to go to France, for example, where it's actually a real culture shock when you go to France as a 19-year-old New Caledonian and realize that you're much more than just being French. You're actually from the Pacific Islands. I remember my first year in France with my friends from New Caledonia going to, there was a little show organized by the Association of Students from New Caledonia, and there was Kanak dances and songs, and we all started crying just hearing this.
Yeah, so I guess there is that connection that is very specifically New Caledonian and perhaps not French, as you were saying. But it is a complex question. And I know you've said before that you've felt frustrated in the lead up, not only to this referendum, but the one previously in 2018. Why is that? What's the basis of that frustration?
I think it's around reading a lot of reports and sometimes so in the medias, but also because I'm an academic, so I hear a lot about, you know, seminars that are being led about New Caledonia and the referendums in academic circles in France and Australia. And there is this feeling that the story around New Caledonia that kept being told is what is a very simplistic binary one, where I think my generation who grew up in a new, for example, school system where we learned about Kanak history and Kanak values and the history of the événement and the agreements, we felt that the reality was much more complex. And we, you know, when we grew up, we had friends from every communities as well. So we didn't feel that disconnected. So that's the frustration coming from these simplistic stories that are being told.
Mm. And I guess the simplistic stories, would you say, is you're either pro or anti-independence, and that's the extent of it.
Yeah, and if you're Kanak, you're pro-independence. If you're not Kanak, you're anti-independence. And also, it kind of forget that the communities of New Caledonia are not just Kanak or white, you know, people. There is actually a whole range of other heritages that people have.
Mm. And you mentioned the generation that you're in. You know, there was that Les Événements, as you said, the events, which was a civil conflict, really between Kanak pro-independence or Kanak people and pro-independence fighters, and I guess loyalists or the French state as well. Mm-hmm. What were your memories of that? I guess you would have been very, very young when that was all happening. And how has, you know, growing up during that time and your generation influenced the way you think about this vote?
I was still in France at the beginning of the événement, where my parents were finishing their university studies. But then when my mom, who's from New Caledonia, saw what was happening, she just bought flight tickets and we all went back to New Caledonia during the event. Because she wanted to be in her country. So we arrived in the middle of that. And so my memories, you know, that was when I was between 5 and 8 years old. So my memories are a bit blurry, but the The most specific memory I have is the day when we learned that Jean-Marie Tjibaou had been killed. And I remember that my mom and us with her were all just really extremely sad.
And that was Jean-Marie Tjibaou who you said
yes.
was killed, and who was the, I guess, the leader of the Kanak pro-independence fighters, is that right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. So that's my most very specific memory I have as a kid from this period of time.
And you mentioned before about how, you know, you felt frustrated that this question of independence is also always related to an ethnic question of whether you're Kanak or not Kanak, and that means that's going to dictate the way you vote. We did see, I know, in 2018, in the first referendum, that we see that there has been some influence with ethnicity and the way this vote is coming out and the way these conversations are happening. Do you think that's true? And do you think there's a possibility of overcoming not just that generational divide that you spoke about, but also this divide between identity and ethnicity that also seems to be in New Caledonia as well?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, there is a divide that exists, you know, between the majority of areas that are mainly settled by Kanak people in New Caledonia voting for independence, and the areas where there are less Kanak people voting against independence. But there is also, I think, clearly a possibility to go above that. And I think also very often, the geography of the vote is more related to urban areas versus non-urban areas. And so in non-urban areas, that's where you'll find a lot of non-Kanak voting for independence. And the urban areas, it's where you'll find a number of Kanak voting against independence. So there is also this fact. So it's, you know, even though the basic lines are there, when you go into the details, there is room for a much more complex representation.
What does that mean for the 4th of October then, both for you and I guess the rest of the territory, but particularly for you? How has thinking about the complexities here, how will that influence you when you, I guess, go and vote?
I'm completely part of these 25% of undecided people, because as we were saying, there's all the reflection you're doing around the history and the socioeconomic and also the political and regional position of New Caledonia. And then there's your emotional reaction to all of this and your families and, you know, this kind of question. And I think a lot of people in New Caledonia are in the same situation. There are certainly a number of people who know right from the start exactly what they're going to vote for. But what I see is that in New Caledonia, there's a lot of discussion going on around the referendum. Within, you know, group of friends and families, but also organized by cultural institution, the university, the government. So there is a lot of discussion going on and a lot of debates.
That was archaeology professor and New Caledonian Dr. Emily Dotsaro speaking there to Priyanka Srinivasan.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. Coming up next, we'll get a weather report from Neville Coop from Nandraki Weather and find out the latest stories making news around the region with Jordan Fennell. But first, some music for your Monday. This is Lynn Tone, Baby Teller and Moose with Tuvaluan Girl.
No.
That was Lynn Tone there with Baby Teller and Moose, or it might be pronounced Mouse, so apologies for that if I've got that wrong, with their song Tuvaluan Girl that was released this year. Neville Coop is the director of Nandraki Weather and joins us now for a weather update. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, good morning, Talia.
How's it looking out there today, Neville?
We've had a pretty quiet weekend across the South Pacific. Big high pressure south of Cook Islands is keeping the trade winds going across the tropics and keeping weather pretty settled. Pretty nasty over New Zealand during the weekend. They've had a burst of winter weather, but elsewhere, just the odd shower about the Solomons and spreading across to Tuvalu and Rotuma, north of Fiji. But pretty much everywhere else is fine and clear. We do have another tropical system north of the equator. It's well off to the east of Japan right now, and not going to affect any land areas. So we'll just chalk that one up as another one for the northern hemisphere this season, but it's not going to affect anybody.
Indeed. And aside from some weather news, we've also got a space update, because I know that you like to cast your eye up into the heavens. And I understand there's going to be a blue moon next month. What exactly is a blue moon? How does that work?
Okay, well, let me start by saying that on the 1st of October, which is on Thursday, we're going to have a full moon. When we have a full moon early in the month, particularly a month with 31 days, it does mean we can squeeze a second full moon into the same calendar month. Now, that is one of two definitions of a blue moon, when you have two complete full moons within one calendar month. The more ancient and historic definition is when you have four full moons in a season, so between an equinox and a solstice. We're not going to have that this time, but we are going to have two because on the 31st of October, we'll have another full moon. So that's a blue moon. It's not blue, obviously. Yes. It's nothing to do with the colour, but historically it's just been known as a blue moon. And if you look for the moon rising on Thursday, you'll see it. It's very close to Mars, which is shining very red at the moment because it's in opposition. It's at its closest point to the Earth right now. So good skies to the east just after dark. If you look up midweek, you'll see the moon and Mars very close together.
Sounding good. And here I was just thinking Blue Moon was a song by Elvis Presley. It turns out it's also an astronomical phenomenon as well. I knew it would have had to get its name from somewhere. And no doubt you'll remind us again during the week of where to look and what we will be able to see. But thank you so much for the update, Neville, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
Okay, thanks, Talia.
Thank you. That was Neville Coop there. He's the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, you can always visit their Facebook page. You'll find them at Nandraki Weather. Time now to find out some of the stories making news in the region today. And to do that, I'm joined by Jordan Fennell. Hello, Jordan.
Hello, Talia.
Now, like we always like to do on a Monday, especially after the weekend and during a global pandemic, is kind of get a wrap up of the COVID-19 cases in the region, because we have seen a rise in cases in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, that's right. It's a small rise, but we've heard out of the Office of the Emergency Controller in PNG that there has been two more cases in the National Capital District in the last 24 hours. Both of those cases are quite young. One was 23 years old, one 34 years old. One was a taxi driver who was asymptomatic and had been driving around, and the other a hotel worker, who presented with fever symptoms. And the national controller, emergency controller, did say that this was evidence of community transmission. So a good reminder to people in the National Capital District and PNG to continue social distancing, wearing a mask, washing your hands, and all those protocols. These new cases bring the total confirmed cases in the NCD alone to 318 now, and for Papua New Guinea to 534 in total. Over to Tahiti, Radio New Zealand is reporting that there's been an outbreak of COVID at a prison where 20 people have been infected. Figures released by the French Polynesian government on Friday said that to date they had 1,579 cases, including six deaths. Over in New Caledonia, they've registered another COVID-19 case in its quarantine facility, bringing its tally to 27. While over in Guam, as they're winding down some of their COVID-19 restrictions, the island has actually recorded its 39th death from the virus, very sadly. And the BBC reports that the World Health Organization, looking at a global scale, the World Health Organization has said that the global coronavirus death toll could hit 2 million before an effective vaccine is widely used.
It's kind of crazy, isn't it? It's just like everything that is happening in 2020 makes you look at health and vaccines and all that science and all that medicine and everything that goes into it just so much differently, because as you can see, during this pandemic, its effect on public health can just spread so easily once, you know, there are community transmissions and people can move it around. But I think I wouldn't be surprised if it inspires a whole generation of doctors who are now just like, oh, actually medicines is pretty cool and developing vaccines is pretty cool, because they're conversations that we just don't normally have.
Well, I read an article the other day where a doctor had expressed that the idea of going into public health a few years ago was not very cool, whereas now people who have gone into public health are considered the rock stars of the doctor world, because they're out here literally saving everyone.
Yeah, exactly. And we just have to see, like here in Victoria, Brett Sutton, who's our health thing, is like people were actually putting his face on masks and bedspreads. Yes. Is how much of a rock star he is right now. So
have I been tempted to buy a pillow with his face on it? Maybe.
Okay, an intervention is obviously needed for Jordan. Let's go to some other news, because there's some trans-Tasman travel news, because a travel bubble, the long-awaited travel bubble between New Zealand and Australia, could be open within weeks.
I know. Look, it feels like we've been teased by this for literally the whole year. It was raised way back in May and then was shelved numerous times because of different outbreaks across Australia and New Zealand. But last Friday, Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison, in a national cabinet meeting, did raise it again, suggesting the formation of a travel bubble, but with a few amendments from original discussions all those months ago. At the moment, what's being considered is really only a one-way travel bubble, with Kiwis being able to head to Australia without quarantining to holiday in Australia. However, only those from the South Island, because those in the North Island, there is an outbreak. But Australians, no word on whether we would actually be allowed to go to New Zealand itself. So great news for the Kiwis, which is excellent. Australia's Minister for Tourism, Simon Birmingham, went on the Australia's Nines Today show, saying he hoped that Australians would be able to freely travel to New Zealand by the end of the year. And then this morning, New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern told TVNZ1's breakfast show that a state-by-state trans-Tasman bubble would be possible before Christmas.
I love that it's becoming less of a bubble and like everyone's in it as much as it is like a one-way freeway with a very specific like destination, and you cannot get off at any other stops. It's just A to B and then that person can return back. But yet it still inspires so much hope that one day, you know, international travel as we once knew it will be restored again. Jordan, finally to some sporting news, and the Tonga Rugby Union has agreed to some governance changes. There's been a whole lot of drama going on there as well. So what's happened?
That's right. You would have heard our resident rugby expert, Richard Hewitt, bringing us most of this news last week in the lead up to this Tonga Rugby situation. It was reported last week that the Tonga Rugby Union was in danger of being relegated to a tier 3 on the world ladder unless an interim management team could be put in place while ongoing governance issues were being resolved. Now, according to Radio New Zealand, the Tonga Rugby Union has signed a tripartite agreement now between the TRU, Tongan government and World Rugby. They've agreed to new governing arrangements, which will see an interim management group take charge of the union until so-called long-standing governance issues are resolved. And importantly, this tripartite agreement will see much needed funds flow into high performance and community rugby in the country.
Which, of course, is so important, even though sport is kind of still at a bit of a standstill with the global pandemic. It's ensuring that those skills are still there, they're still being met. And then obviously, you know, looking at, you know, the Tongan rugby team with rugby championships, you know, all those kind of things. It's some good news for Tongan
positive
fans. who I think that, you know, they've had to go through this as well as the Tongan Rugby Union. It's always the fans who are just like, I just want to support my team play.
Exactly.
Like, forget about what's happening off the field. Exactly. Exactly. Jordan, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
No worries.
That was Jordan Fennell there bringing us a wrap of the news this Monday, the 28th of September. Coming up next, Elsie the Jukebox Albert.
The jukebox, hey, it's pretty much because of the hits that I put in the field.
Isn't that great? You get a name because of the hits that you take when you're a rugby person. She obviously is someone to watch. And this weekend, she'll make her Australian NRL women's competition debut. And the jukebox will join Pacific Beat.
Wherever you are in the world, watch stories from home, anytime, with the new ABC Australia iView app. Never miss a moment of the programs you love.
From Four Corners.
Welcome to Landline.
London America is back.
Hello and welcome to 7:30.
We are having that debate.
And the stories that matter.
We owe it to people to tell the real story, to bring people the truth.
Download the new ABC Australia iView app. Yours to explore, anywhere, anytime.
So why not check it out?
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. This weekend, history will be made. Elsie Albert is set to become the first Papua New Guinean-born player to make her Australian NRL women's debut when she puts on the Illawarra Dragons jersey this weekend. The 24-year-old, who's also the captain for the PNG national side, the Orchids, and who's earned the nickname the Jukebox, says she had more than one club wanting to sign her. And after months of COVID uncertainty, the 2020 NRLW season begins this weekend, and today Elsie will join the rest of the Dragons squad for the very first time. Elsie the Jukebox Albert caught up with reporter Hilda Wayne.
And there she is, Elsie Albert.
That's outstanding.
Welcome to the Nines.
Hi, my name's Elsie Albert, and I am the first homegrown PNG export to play in the NRLW for the Dragons.
Well, that's a bomb rattler. Elsie Albert.
The jukebox, hey, is that the nickname you were referring to? It's pretty much because of the hits that I put in the field. I think I just got the name after the World Cup Nines in Sydney last year.
She's just been absolutely unstoppable, both with the ball and without the ball. Here's the big run she did just before she had her first break.
Thank you so much, Elsie, for your time. How are you feeling right now?
Mixed emotions. Yeah, I'm just humbled, and I'm just excited that I get this opportunity to play in the NRLW. I can't really explain the feeling, you know, growing up watching people like Jonathan Thurston. Back then, when there's no women league televised on the TV, Jonathan Thurston and Greg Inglis and Paul Garlin and Cameron Smith, you know, watching all these blokes playing, and then you would cheer for them. And now, like, I can't wrap my head around this feeling that I get to play in that same arena as they played. It's overwhelming, and it's really, I'm just so excited.
So tell us a bit about yourself. When did you start actually playing rugby league?
I started playing when I left high school, when I went to uni. I played in the girls' team in the university. I just played because no girls wanted to play full-on body contact. So, yeah, just to make up the number, I joined the girls, and then we went playing. And from there, pretty much I got selected to represent the East New Britain. And then from East New Britain, I went on to represent the NGI. It's a region in back home. So from there, they selected the squad to play in the Orchids. So yeah, that's how I made it into the Orchids. And now I am where I am today.
But it hasn't been easy. Your family, what was the reaction like? And you have mentioned earlier on that religion played a big part in your choices.
Pretty much our religion is denomination doesn't allow girls to wear trousers or, you know, wear short skirts and everything. But yeah, I pretty much, you know, I don't like sharing this on the, you know, public, because I don't want to look bad. you know, for supporting me to, oh, okay, now they'll say that, oh, their parents are allowing you to do that. So, yeah, they respect my decision. They respect my decision, yeah. That's yeah. my decision. Like, it's not going to affect them, or it's my life and I can do whatever I want. That's the way they understand it now. And, yeah.
What was the atmosphere like when the PNG Orchids went into the PRL to play your game for the first time? What was the crowd like?
I would say thanks to the girls who came before me and, you know, laying the platform. You know, they were the ones who were being ridiculed by the, you know, male folks. And like when they were playing in the field, people would, especially men folks, saying that girls are not supposed to play rugby. You guys are just wasting your time. Just get married and have babies and just stay home. And they would throw containers, empty containers into the room. Sometimes they would hit the players with the inside the field with the containers. They throw like Coke bottles or, you know, water bottles into the field. And thanks to those pioneers who came before me and laying the platform, and like people like me, I just came, joined them in 2018 and enjoying the things that, you know, other people went before me. And now we're changing. I mean, like, I'm glad that, like, I'm being a part of this change to change the minds, changing perspective, changing way the men folks think towards women. The big difference that I could see is when we played against England last year. It's like, before that, you don't see, most men do not support the ladies playing. And last year's game, you know, me standing inside the field, and I could hear men folks also saying, "Go the Orchids!" Like that meant a lot.
And Saint Jolewara is like a top team now in the Women's League.
Yeah.
Are you prepared to join that big club and team and play?
Yeah, it's a big challenge for me. They've always been good. They've always been a good side. You know, to have that confidence that I am going to, you know, provide the skill set that I have for them to lay the platform and for the backs to move freely. And they see that in me. That's why they signed me. And I'm pumped and I'm really excited to, you know, get in there and gel with the ladies and then play on Saturday.
And did other clubs make any offers, or was St. George the only one?
I had a few clubs, but yeah, decided to stick with the Dragons.
And he also have a special relationship with Steph Hancock.
One up into the sky, it goes for Coolwell's. Loud the bounce, Hancock, can she get it? She does, gets the offload, try time. Oh, Steph Hancock, genius, comes to Bishop Park and they come up with a try.
Yeah.
Just more about her.
Yeah, we have a special relationship in the field. Like, she plays on the left, I play on the right, and we're the props, and she's my role model. Like, I look up to her. You wouldn't believe that she's a 38-year-old playing in the field. Like, she doesn't run like a 38-year-old. She runs like she just joined and she's tried to prove something that, you know, she wants to prove something. But when I learned that she was 38, oh, I was blown. But she's my big role model, and I look up to her, and I'm just thankful that she's going with me to the Dragons, because she wanted to make me feel welcomed, you know, being new to the scene of the RLW. And yeah, just thankful that she will be going with me to the Dragons.
And what would be your message to a young girl or girl in PNG wanting to play rugby league? What would be your message to her?
My message would be, people will throw negative comments here, there, and everywhere, saying that that's not a girl's sport, man. You're not supposed to play that. But well, look at me. I'm the perfect example for people saying that. But just my advice would be, if you want to play rugby, just pick up a ball, join a team in PNG, and just pass the ball around and work hard and stay dedicated, and you shall see the benefits.
Albert, full of running, puts a right arm, fend on Ward. Still going is Albert. Albert, get out of my way. Albert will go to the try line, and Albert will go over and score, and the try machine keeps rumbling along, and that's done it again here at Bishop Park.
We'll be expecting some big things from the try machine and the tackle machine. That was new Illawarra Dragons recruit PNG's own Elsie Albert, a.k.a. the Jukebox. And she was speaking there with Hilda Wayne. And if you want more Elsie Albert, I know I do, then head on over to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page later today to hear and see more of that chat with Elsie.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Talia Olatia. Coming up next, you're going to meet a 16-year-old student who's recently started creating dignity kits to address period poverty in her home of Fiji. But first, a little bit of music for your Monday morning. This is Ali X with Hello.
It's finally real. I found my fantasy. Remember the day when I heard you say, hello, take a little follow. I can love you for the rest of my life. Don't you ever let me go. It's funny with the hello. I can be a superhero. I can love you for the rest of my life.
Little fun song to get you up and moving on this Monday morning. That was Canadian artist Ali X with the song Hello.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat, and you might remember Anne-Marie Runduva as the 16-year-old climate activist from Fiji who travelled to New York this time last year to showcase their solutions to that issue at a United Nations climate summit. But now she's finding solutions to another problem she's discovered in Fiji. With the help of her 13-year-old sister, Anne-Marie has been creating what she calls dignity kits for women and girls who are struggling to access sanitary products. So far, the teenage duo have given out more than 600 kits. Reporter Marla Damati caught up with Anne-Marie Runduva.
My name is Anne-Marie Runduva, and the campaign that my sisters and I organize is called the Lani Lani Relief Campaign.
Firstly, what inspired you to start the relief drive?
When it started, the Lani Lani Relief Drive was after Fiji was hit badly by a Category 4 Tropical Cyclone Harold and also COVID-19 earlier this year in April. We found that women and girls are often ignored when it comes to disaster recovery assistance. And there are a lot of assistance for relief work and distributions of essentials such as food, water, shelter and clothing. And women and girls lack the basic sanitation resources during their monthly menstruation period. And we felt like, yes, food and water, shelter and clothing are also important, but we should also make sanitary care a priority. And my sister and I, since Randova, who is 13 years old, and I asked our parents if we could organize a campaign to help women and girls gain their dignity again, so that we started distributing the dignity kits. And in those kits, it's with a Ziploc bag, and in the Ziploc bag are sanitary pads, toothbrush, toothpaste, and a bathing soap. My sisters and I have distributed more than 600 dignity kits to disaster-affected areas and communities, and also to the COVID-19-affected families as well.
So the work that you are doing is amazing, Anne-Marie. Now, in your experience, did you see that the COVID-19 pandemic specifically makes sanitary products more expensive, and how much were they costing, or how much more expensive did they become?
Yes, the sanitary care products have increased. While conducting the campaign, a lot of people have asked me and my sisters, why are we helping the COVID-19 affected families. The COVID-19 pandemic has really impacted those people who have been laid off from work, and those people who are working are earning less than before. So now the focus is, you know, on food and water, and also bills, electricity bills, rent and water bills. So it's just a lot of money that has gone, and the sanitary care products for women are at the bottom item to buy on the grocery list. And we feel, you know, good and empowered to help other people during these hard and challenging times.
How much do pads cost in Fiji? If you were to go to the shops and buy pads, on average, do you know how much they cost?
Maybe a sanitary pad can cost about $5.50 a pad. I'm not sure, because sometimes it increases in the supermarket.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic, like you said, Fiji was hit by TC Harold. But, you know, in general senses, do you find that, you know, pads and sanitary items can be hard to come by or hard to afford and find in Fiji generally?
Yes. A lot of, before the COVID-19 pandemic happened and before the Tropical Cyclone Harold, a lot of women and girls, they use all sorts of toilet papers, pads and all clothes as an alternative, because they can't afford these basic sanitary care. And we found out that a lot of women and girls, they cannot attend work in school because they can't afford all these sanitary resources. And I think that we need to end period poverty now.
Working in this space and working, you know, with the Langi Langi Relief Drive, what have the women and girls in Fiji been telling you about their situations?
It's really sad with what the story is about, like how they survive, like, you know, with their menstruation period without using these sanitary care products. And it's heartbreaking to see and to hear stories of women and girls, you know, just telling us. And it gives my sisters and I that, you know, we are empowered to help to do more of these dignity kits than just to distribute it to women and girls. We must all help each other during these hard times and challenging times, and we must make sanitary care a priority, because we never know how many women and girls face period poverty in silence.
It really shows that, you know, at any age you can be looking out for others. And that was 16-year-old Fijian student Anne-Marie Rundeva, who was speaking there to Marla Damati. Along with her sister, they've set up the Langi Langi Relief Drive, which helps give dignity kits for women and girls who are struggling to access sanitary products. And she was speaking there to reporter Marla Damati.
Love sport? Join Rock and Cav every Thursday night across the Pacific.
Can you be more Pacific?
Each week they'll have their own unique take on all things sport.
Ratu Ngolea, what a legend. I'm so proud of that young man.
That guy is on his way to being at the same status as Nick Maitanui, I reckon.
Oh, wow, that's a big call.
Right. I'm calling it, man.
Thursday nights across the Pacific.
With Sonny Bill, you also get the aura around Sonny Bill.
You know what? That aura you speak of, yes, brings the best out of players.
They see a guy that they've looked up to.
And that's
their whole
the
life.
Difference between Benji Marshall.
Yes.
See, we just unlocked the vault right now.
We ask questions and then we answer them later.
Exactly. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. We've just unlocked
the NRL Da Vinci Code. Rock and Cav, unlocking codes.
Can you be more Pacific? Starts October 8, 6 p.m. Thursday nights, PNG time, on Radio Australia.
that starts October 8th, which is not this Thursday, but next Thursday. And hopefully we'll have Rock and Cav on the Pacific Beat program to give us more of an idea of what that program is going to be about. They said that they're unlocking codes. No doubt league and union will be two of those codes that they are unlocking. And I can't wait to see the conversations that happen on that sports show. But if you are a rugby fan, then Can You Be More Pacific is due to start on October 8th, which is next Thursday. And that is the program for this morning. Don't forget that Richard Ewart will be along for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat at 3 p.m. PNG time. That's 5 p.m. if you're in Fiji or 6 p.m. if you are in Tonga or Samoa. So don't forget to tune in to listen to Richard Ewart this afternoon. But do keep listening to ABC Radio Australia across the day as well. And make sure that you follow and like the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page so you can ensure that you get the latest news and developments from around the region. And if you want to listen back to any of the stories from today or last week or, you know, 3 months ago, then head on over to our website. Just search ABC Pacific Beat into your preferred search engine and you'll be able to find us there. I'm Talia Olatia. Hope you have a good Monday. Fafatai le fa'alongalongu.